2 Samuel chapter 10. As I'm going throughout my day with just different Bible studies, things like that, this past year we went through the life of David with the Royalty Club teens, and as I was going through there, the Lord every now and then will just kind of put something on my heart and say, hey, this will make a really good sermon, write this down. And so this is one of those times, is 2 Samuel chapter 10, and what we see here is a story of David is fighting the Ammonites. And the territory, if you think of a map of the Middle East, is in modern-day Jordan, of what takes place there. But tonight I just want to look at and the idea of spiritual warfare, and are you standing up for what is right? Not necessarily in society as a whole, but with your own personal life and your thought life, are you doing what is proper there? So let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 10, starting in verse 1. It says, "And it came to pass after this, that the king of the children of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his stead. Then David said, I will show kindness unto Hanun the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness unto me. And David sent to comfort him by the hand of his servants for his father. And David's servants came into the land of the children of Ammon. And the princes of the children of Ammon said unto Hanun their lord, Thinkest thou that David doth honor thy father, that he hath sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent these servants unto thee to search the city, and to spy it out, and to overthrow it? Wherefore Hanun took David's servants, and shaved off one half of their beards, and cut off their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away. When they told it unto David, he sent to meet them, because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, Tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown, and they return, and then return. And when the children of Ammon saw that they stank before David, the children of Ammon sent out and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 footmen, and the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and of Ishtal, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the hosts of the mighty men." And so we're going to stop there real quick and look at this part of the story, and then we'll go on, figure out what's happening here in the context of things. So like I said, if you have the picture of the Middle East in your mind, you have the Mediterranean Sea, then you have Israel, the Jordan River, and just on the other side of the Jordan River is modern-day Jordan, the country there. And the Ammonites, they were centralized in central Jordan. Their capital, Amman, is the modern-day capital of Jordan as well as what they had there. So David sees and hears that the king of the Ammonites has died. Previously in the history between them, the king had shown grace to David. He had helped him while he was running from Saul. And so David's like, the father was good to me, I'm going to be good to the son. Sends out these emissaries, these ambassadors, to rebuild the ties there because it's a new king, so they need new policies, things like that. When they get there, the king of Ammon looks and listens to his counselors, see these as ambassadors, as spies, shaves half their beard, destroys their clothing, and then sends them back in disgrace. And so that's what he does there. That's what he goes. And then David hears about this and sends his army out there. Verse 7, it talks about, when David heard of it, he sent Joab and the host of his mighty men. The mighty men of David is one of the fighting forces of the Bible that I love to study. If you've ever gone through and studied even the individuals of that, it is a fascinating study to see what they've done, what the Lord did through them. And we're going to look at four of their names tonight and to look at it and to ask yourself, as we're going through this, why did they do it? And then again, for a modern application with our lives, are we standing up for what is right as well? And so we see that the Ammonites hire the Syrian army, and David sends out his army, the mighty men, and go to verse 8. It says, "And the children of Ammon came out and put in battle an array at the entering of the gate, and the Syrians of Zobah and Rahab and Ishtob and Mecca were by themselves in the field. When Joab saw that the front of the battle was against him, before and behind, he chose all of the choice men of Israel and put them in array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he delivered into the hand of Abishai his brother, that he might put them in array against the children of Ammon. And he said, If the Syrians be too strong for me, then thou shalt help me. But if the children of Ammon be too strong for thee, then I will come and help thee. Be of good courage, and let us play the men of our people, and for the cities of our God and the Lord do that which seemeth him good. And Joab drew nigh, and the people that were with him, unto the battle against the Syrians. And they fled before him. And when the children of Ammon saw that the Syrians were fled, they fled they also before Abishai, and entered into the city. So Joab returned from the children of Ammon, and came to Jerusalem. And so we're going to stop there. The story goes, they engage in a battle, the Syrian mercenaries are routed by Joab and his part of the army, and so the Ammonites, realizing they can't stand against both sides, they retreat into their own city, their capital city. This is one of the places we were able to visit when we were in Jordan this past few weeks ago, months ago that we were there, and we were able to see the citadels, what it's called today, where they would have gone and defended against this attack. It's on the top of a large hill. It is surrounded by hills. There is only one easy way to get into this citadel, this fortress that was up there. And the rest of it was almost a sheer cliff that you would have had to climb hands and foot to get up there. And so we see what's taking place there. But what I want to look here necessarily is not the battle that takes place here, but the men that are fighting it, these mighty men. Verses 6 and 7, as I mentioned, talks about them. But it says that David sends out his army made up of mighty men. These were the personal army, the personal bodyguard of David as he had been going through the desert fleeing from Saul. And as he was going there, these men that were with him, they were not stand-up spiritual men. They were not men that were following David because they thought he was the rightful king. Many of these people were mercenaries themselves. They were outlaws or in some way politically taking political asylum from their particular country. He had Hittites, he had Egyptians, he had Israelites, Ammonites, all fighting for him. And this band that was there fought for him because they were loyal to David. And when they fought and when they won, they were repaid by David, so their loyalty grew for him, and they loved David. And so we see these couple of these things here. Turn over 2 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 1. And we'll look at some of these men that it's talking about, these mighty men. Verse 1 of chapter 23. As after this takes place here in chapter 22, is the Song of David, talks about is celebrating his exploits of what he did. Verse 1 of chapter 23 says, "Now these be the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, said, And the man who was raised up on high, and the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, said, The Spirit of the Lord spake unto me, by his word was in, and his word was in my tongue. And the God of Israel said, And the rock of Israel spake to me, He that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." And let's skip over to verse 8. Now where we see here, David is saying, okay, if you're ruling, you need to rule justly. It says, "These be the name of the mighty men whom David had, the Tachamite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains. The same was Adonai the Ezonite, and he lifted up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the three mighty men with David, when they defied the Philistines that were gathered together to battle, and the men of Israel were gone away. He rose and smote the Philistines until his hands were weary and his hand clave unto the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to spoil. And after him was Shema, the son of Agi, the Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. And the people fled from the Philistines. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it and slew the Philistines, and the Lord wrought a great victory. And three of the 30 chief went down and came to David at the harvest time unto the cave of Abdul, and the troop of the Philistines pitched in this valley of Rephaim." And so what I want to look here, the first one is the guy named Adonai the Ezonite that they're talking about here. Who was he? What did he do? Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about him, but as we see there in verse 8, it says that he killed 800 men with his spear. When everybody else fled, when everybody else ran away from the battle, these soldiers of Israel, he's the one that stood and fought. And a lot of times we look at it and say, well, why is it that it always seems like the army of Israel is running away? Why does it always seem to be that way? Well, if we look at it historically, one of the reasons is because Israel had a light military, a light infantry army. They would have had wicker shields, they would have had spears made of wood, bow staffs, things like that, very few swords, and they would have had slingers, or guys with David's type of slingshot. They did not have the iron armor or the iron chariots of the tribes and nations that were in the valleys. They were a very light infantry army, so when they came across an army, if you're fighting a stick against a sword, you're probably not going to stay there and fight for very long. And so they would run away all the time. But here we see that this one man who had known how to fight, that he goes through and he kills 800 men standing his ground there. Verse 8, it talks about that when he did this, when he stood there and fought, that he held them off there. And another time in 1 Chronicles, it says another account where he stood and fought, and 300 men that he slew was that place there. So this was a guy who did not give up even when he was outnumbered. There was a small field that it talks about that he fought in with the lentils, or as a bean field. Not the best place to be fighting beans, often the type of plant that they are. They can be in a vine or something like that, not good for footing or things like that. But he didn't get to choose his battlefield. He didn't get to choose the place where God wanted him to stand and fight. Now, we don't know the spiritual aspect a lot of these men would have been at this time, but we do know that he stood and fought for Israel. And so, by extension there, he stood and fought for the Lord. And just like Adonai here had no idea where he was going to fight, we ourselves don't know when a spiritual battle is going to take place. We don't get to pick our battlefields. I've been reading a just a biography of Stonewall Jackson over the past several months. And in it, it talks about how the different armies of the North and the South, depending on who had the advantage, they would set up their armies on their choice of battlefield. And if you have the upper hand, oftentimes that's how you're able to do it. You are able to set up, pick where you want to fight that would be most advantageous to you. In our Christian life, we very rarely get to pick our spiritual battlefield. When something comes up in our lives, it can be either something that just blindsides us or something that we may see coming, but when it comes there, we don't get to pick the field to fight on. And there we see that he did not turn and run. He was one of those that it talks about in Ezekiel 22:30, where God is looking for someone to stand in the gap. As I mentioned this morning, there are a lot of followers in the world, but often it only takes a few people, one person, to stand up and to start doing the right thing. It talks about in this passage that after he fought this battle, the rest of the army came back simply to spoil or to take the goods of the battle, is what he did there. And we see what takes place there. And so the soldiers, the spiritual battle that we're going through, and we are soldiers of Christ that we are fighting in, we don't get to pick where we get to fight. But being spirit-filled, committed to Christ, knowing that he is on our side, wherever that battle is, we are able to have that courage to stand and fight, whatever that battle may be. Whether that is a coworker who brings something up, whether that is a friend or supposed friend who hits you with something, or a betrayal, or a thought, attitude that comes in there. With Christ's help, with God's help, we are able to fight these battles just like this man was able to stand and fight his battle there. So we have that man there, the Adonai the Esnite, and you should be in 2 Samuel right now, chapter 23. Look at verse 11 and 12 there. It talks about these two here, that it goes through there, and it goes through, talks about three of the people there that were able to help him. And the one guy, Shimon, it says that he stood and fought while everyone else ran. That mentioned him in verse 11 there. And then Eleazar, who stood and fought where others also ran. In another passage of the Bible, it gives another reference to this fight here, where it says that this man stood and fought for so long that his sword broke. That after his sword broke, he kept fighting, and the muscles of his hands contracted in such a way that he could not let go of his sword by the time the battle was done. It took a while, several hours, for his hand to relax because of how long he'd been fighting there. And so these two people here, that they have their swords that they were fighting with. And I don't want to try to draw a super comparison, be like, they fought with the sword there and we have the sword of the Lord today. But we do. And we can't look at and make allegories of the Old Testament stories and apply every little parts of our lives there. But in this instance here, we are able to see and understand a little bit that with these two men having their swords standing and fighting, they did not stand and fight with their fists or with their feet, things like that. They would have if they needed to. But in our lives, we don't need to stand alone. We don't have to stand alone. We have the sword of the Lord that is with us. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 12, you don't need to turn there, but it says, "For the word of the Lord is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and the joints of the marrow, and he is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart." I love the picture there that it gives. If you've ever done any type of research or you've joined military history or fighting of anything like that, then you can understand the importance of a two-edged sword. There are multiple different types of swords out there. In fencing, you have something called a foil. It's got many of them have the blunted end, something there. It is a sword used for jabbing and quick strokes. You could have a rapier, which is mainly for horseback, where it would be sharp on the one side, maybe a few jabs, but not something you want to get into a long, extended battle with something there. You could have the Teutonic German broadsword that would be sometimes 4 to 6 feet long. That with that sword, it wasn't sharp, but when they took it up and they dropped it on an opponent, it would just crush bone and metal that was going through there. And these aren't those type of... The Bible, it says, is not those kind of swords. It's not something for a few slashes and a quick stroke. It's not something to be used in only a specific situation like a rapier. It's not something like a broadsword that once you drop it once, it takes you a long time to pick it back up and swing it again. The Bible, it says, is a sharp, two-edged sword. Meaning that no matter what takes place in the battle, if you have a two-edged sword, if somebody attacks from your left or your right, you don't have to change position in order to defend yourselves or to go on the attack. The point there that it talks, it says it's piercing, so it has a sharp point at the front there. So this sword is good for blocking, it's good for slashing, it is good for piercing or attacking. And that's what the Bible is for. It is not something that's, okay, you can only use it in certain situations and other places it's not applicable. No, any battle that we get in, any situation that arises around us, God is saying, you have the word of the Lord. You have the sword of the Lord. Use it. But just like with any tool, if you are not trained how to use it, you can't use it properly. Just as in battle, if you were not trained back then to properly use a sword, then when you go out there, you lose the faith, you lose your courage, and you drop the sword and you flee. With our Bibles, it is the same thing. We have to be continually in the Bible learning the Word of God, learning how to use it, learning not just to defend, but also to attack. Because a sword is not a simply defensive weapon. It can be used as a defense. But the Lord gave us the Word of God. It doesn't say to defend against the enemy's attacks, to keep yourself from getting hurt. No, it says that He gave us the sword of the Lord to pierce and to divide the soul and the spirit, to go to the joints of the marrow, to go to the very center of what is taking place there. Battle armor back then had weak points. If you hit somebody in the chest, the blow would glance off. In the shoulders, it would glance off. But you had to be able to have movement. So the joints were the weak spots. So if you were able to get the sword into the underneath the shoulder pad or into an elbow or a knee, something like that, you got in where it was vulnerable, where it would do the most damage or the most work against the enemy. Here in our lives, in our daily lives with the Bible, that's what the Lord is saying. He's saying, look at the people around us. Look at yourselves. Go to your weak areas and use the Bible there. Figure out what needs to be changed. Use the scriptures. Discern the thoughts and the intents of the heart. Looking at this verse here, if you compare it to another verse in the Bible that says that the heart is desperately wicked, who can know it? So we look at that there. Well, the Disney philosophy is if you've ever watched any Disney princess movie, there's almost a single line that goes throughout all those movies, and it's trust your heart or follow your heart, something there. Well, and that's great, an idea thing that looking at for little girls, just follow your heart, you know, be proud of yourself, something like that. But if you really look at the philosophy there, following your hearts, well, compared to what God says, that our hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked, who can know it? We don't want to be following our hearts all the time. So if our hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked, how in the world can we live with ourselves? Is with the Bible. Because with the Bible, with the words that God has given us here, that is the discerner of the thoughts and the spirit of what we have, of what goes on there. So these three men that I've talked about here so far, Eleazar and Shimon, they were war heroes at this point. They would have, the stories that they had would have gone forth and been told across the country. David was a war hero. The song that it talks about says that Saul killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s. These were military heroes that were put up there. Another man named Benaniah, who I've talked about before, later becomes the commander of the armies of Israel underneath the rule of Solomon. He's one of my favorite Old Testament characters that's associated with David. And he goes through, talks about in 1 Chronicles that he jumps into a pit in the middle of winter and slew a lion. In other places, he killed two great champions of Moab. He disarmed the Egyptian mercenary and killed him with his own weapon. All of these things here that he did, that he went through, took place. The king of Moab, he dealt with different things there of what was taking place. And these four men, Benaniah, Adino, Eleazar, and Shimon, they did not wake up in the morning one day and say, you know, I think I'm going to be a war hero today. I'm going to find a really tough situation. I'm going to go, I'm going to get in it, and I'm going to slay 800 men. I'm going to fight until my sword breaks and it sticks to my hand. I'm going to look for a pit with a lion in it and kill it. No, they didn't do those things. They didn't wake up and want to do those things. What they did, they woke up and they did what they were supposed to in the area, in the responsibilities that they had. These men were warriors. Their responsibility was to go out and to fight with their war as a warrior. And when they did what was right, then they saw that they were blessed. A more modern example of this is a man named Audie Murphy. And I want to read something about this man to you. And who he was is just amazing. And it's a few paragraphs long. But he was the most decorated soldier of the United States Army during World War II. And I'm going to read some of his exploits here. It says, when he fought in the European theater, Murphy received the Distinguished Service Cross for actions taken on 15th of August, 1944, during the first wave of the Allied invasion of southern France. After landing on Yellow Beach near Ratinelle, Murphy's platoon was attacked by German soldiers while making their way through a vineyard. He retrieved a machine gun that had been detached from the squad and returned fire at the German soldiers, killing two and wounding one. Two Germans exited a house about 100 yards away and appeared to surrender. When Murphy's friend approached, they shot and killed him. Murphy advanced alone on the house under direct fire, killing six, wounding two, and taking 11 prisoners. Murphy was with the 1st Battalion on August 27th to 28th and on an offensive to secure different areas there. Murphy, his first Purple Heart, was for a heel wound received in a mortar shell blast in northeast France. He got a Silver Star after he killed four and wounded three Germans at a machine gun position. 3 days later, Murphy crawled alone towards the Germans, carrying a radio, directing his men for an hour while the Germans fired directly at him. When his men finally took the hill, 15 Germans had been killed and 35 wounded. Murphy's actions earned him the Bronze Oak Leaf Cluster for a Silver Star. He was awarded a battlefield commission to second lieutenant, which elevated to a platoon leader. Later, he was captured two Germans after being shot in the hip by a sniper. He returned fire and shot the sniper, killing him. At the third hospital, he was got injured and got another Purple Heart. Later, there was an area that had been held by German troops since November of 1944, and in January of the next year, he joined his platoon to take that area. He was wounded in both legs, which he received a second Bronze Oak, or a third Purple Star, as the company awaited there. Then, as his company awaited on January 26th, the Germans scored a direct hit on an M10 tank destroyer, setting it alight, a tank, forcing the crew to abandon it. Murphy ordered his men to retreat to positions in the woods, remaining alone at his post, shooting his M1 carbine and directing artillery fire via his field radio while the Germans aimed fire directly at his position. Murphy mounted the abandoned burning tank destroyer and began firing its 50 caliber machine gun at the advancing Germans, killing a squad that were crawling towards him. For an hour, Murphy stood on the flaming tank destroyer, returning German fire from foot soldiers and advancing tanks, killing or wounding 50 Germans. He sustained a leg wound during this stand and stopped only after he ran out of ammunition, which also awarded him another medal there. Audie Murphy received, while his service there for the United States, 36 military accommodations, where five of them were from France and Belgium. But this man, he did all of these things before he was 19 years old. He joined the military under false pretenses, lying about his age in order to get into the army. And he did all these things. At 19 years old, he had done these. And so we see that there, just like these other four men that I talked about, Audie Murphy did not join the military thinking, I want to be a great military hero. I want to go and be a great thing here. I want to stand on a flaming tank while defending my platoon against advancing Germans. He didn't do that. No, he did what was his job, what was expected of him, to fight for the United States there, to defend his soldiers the best way he could, and to lead his troops into battle there, directing them, and even at some points telling his men to retreat while he stayed up and took the fire. It's the same thing in our Christian lives. Audie Murphy did not want or have into his goals in his mind there to be a war hero. But in our lives, could we look at situations, could we look at things and say, I am a spiritual war hero? And again, it's not something that we look at and we say, okay, I want to be a spiritual war hero today. I'm going to try to tackle the biggest temptation I can and destroy it. We don't do it for any type of gain that we have or something that we want to do there, a personal encouragement. No, it's something that we do because it's our responsibility. It is something that God has given us as part of the thing to do there. We don't start out our spiritual life thinking, I hope to one day be looked at as a great spiritual mentor. None of us have most likely, none of us in here have done that. But at the end of your life, would somebody be able to look back at you and say, that person encouraged me because of what they went through, because of how they handled their life? When somebody looks back at you, will they be able to look at you and say, this is an example of what you need to be? Paul once told one of his people that he was mentoring, he says, mimic me as I mimic Christ. And a lot of people I've heard have looked at that and says, that's a terrifying thing to say. Because if I'm looking at somebody, be like me as I am like Christ. I don't want to tell somebody to be like me because I know I'm not Christ-like. Is what I've heard a lot of people say, and I understand that thinking and that rationale perfectly. But if our goal is Christ-likeness, and we look at it and say, I would be afraid to tell somebody that, then what's in our life, what is wrong, what is not Christ-like in our lives that we wouldn't want somebody else to emulate, that we wouldn't want somebody else to do? As we wrap it up here, think about those things. Would you be able to say, looking at your life, saying, I want you to be acting like I do, because, not because I am a good person, not because I've got it all together, not because God gave me some special meaning to my life. No, I want you to act like me because I'm acting like Christ. If Christ-likeness is our goal, is what we're going for, is the whole reason of sanctification, then we should be able to. Our goal should have the testimony of follow me as I follow Christ. Because if we are the mirrors of Christ as we are supposed to, if we are the spiritual war heroes of God and of Christ like we are supposed to, then we should have no problem confidently saying that. Now again, I understand that we are not perfect. We are not looking at and trying to do this as saying, I can do this, so do it like me. No, say, I did this because Christ was with me. I want you to be like Christ. Well, how do I be like Christ? Well, let me show you with my life. Let me show you how to be like Christ. Follow me as I follow Christ there. And the big part here is it's easy to look at it and get confident in our own abilities, confident in our own thinkings and our own desires, saying, I was the one who got through that. No, you weren't. No, I wasn't. We got through it because God was on our side and because God was helping there. And that's what our goal needs to be as we go throughout our lives there, as we go throughout our day. Right along with what I was talking about this morning of being an example of the believer. How are you doing it? I'm not asking how well are you doing it, because all of us need to be doing it well. I'm asking how are you doing it? How are you being an example? Would you have an opportunity for somebody to look back and say, this person, put your name into it, influenced me in my life spiritually like this and like this? That's what we need there. Not because somebody can lift up our name, but because somebody can lift up God's name at the end of the day there. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the stories here and the accounts, the truth that we can pull from them, seeing and realizing and understanding what is taking place and what you have for us and what we need to be like. Help those that are here tonight, those that are listening, to take to heart the fact that in their lives we need to be spiritual warriors, that we need to be the spiritual war heroes, not for ourselves or our own gratification or our own edification, but because when we are spiritual warriors successfully, it points out you and it shows the support that we have for you and for your cause, Lord. And again, be with us as we go throughout our day, as we go throughout our week, to remember these things and to keep them in the forefront of our minds and hearts. We ask this in your Son's name. Amen. All right.